Hello everyone, my name is Chloe and welcome to a new season of The Burning Case, a place for critical conversations about our future on this planet and how policy making, but also radical democracy, are essential to make sure that future is not only green, but also fair and inclusive. We'll be chatting about the burning issues of our time, how policies are made, and give you the tools to overhaul the system. Let's get started. Hello, I hope you're doing well. For today's episode, I'd like to try something a little bit different. I'd like you to close your eyes for a second and imagine a very dark place. It's cold, it's almost freezing, and it's black as night as far as sunlight is concerned. It's a kind of place where you can't imagine any life to survive. Yet, there is light, and there is life. Most of the animals that live in this place are bioluminescent, meaning they're able to emit light, just like fireflies. And because this place is so deep, animals have had to develop incredible capacities to eat, survive, and even thrive. This place is the deep sea, meaning everything from 200 to 11,000 meters below the ocean surface, a place that you and I are likely to never see. It's not only amazing from an ecosystem perspective, it's also one of our biggest allies in the fight against climate breakdown, as the ocean sequesters greenhouse gases that are emitted by human activity and responsible for the overall warming of our planet. Hopefully by now you're intrigued, and you probably think, this place sounds like it should be protected, and why the hell would anyone want to go destroy it? Well, that's the point of today's episode, because sadly, yes, the deep sea is in danger. The capitalist system is constantly looking for new lands to exploit, and new barriers to cross to continue growing, at the expense of a livable future. So stay tuned as we dive, no pun intended, into what deep sea mining is and why it's so relevant today. But before, here's Melissa with some hot news of the day.
Hi everyone. Thanks Chloe for taking us to a dark place, even if it's the ocean that we're talking about and not the general mood, thankfully. So hopefully my piece of news will take you to a bright place, as today I'm going to briefly discuss a UN resolution that was adopted last Wednesday. So this resolution will make it easier to hold polluting countries legally accountable for failing to tackle the climate emergency, and the resolution is seen to be a historic victory for climate justice. Even more so, the resolution was led by the Pacific Nation of Vanuatu and youth activist, and was co-sponsored by more than 130 countries. Basically, the resolution states that the UN General Assembly will seek the International Court of Justice opinion on the legal consequences for states that by their acts and omissions damage the climate in such a way that it affects others, particularly small island nations who are among the most vulnerable to the effects of climate change. This resolution is hopeful news, as it's the first time that it's attempted to establish climate action obligations under international law, which, even though it isn't technically binding, is an influential tool on national judges and governments. So congratulations to all the activists that took part in making this resolution happen. And now let's jump right into today's episode with Chloe.
Thanks, Melissa. Back to deep sea mining indeed. And to discuss this, I am very happy to welcome today Anne-Sophie Roux, who is a French ocean activist and who has been extremely involved in campaigning against deep sea mining. So hello, Anne-Sophie. Thank you so much for being here today. First of all, how are you? Because I know you've been extremely busy in the past few weeks. And what is your coffee order?
Hi, Chloe. Thank you for having me. I'm doing great. A bit busy, as you said, with the negotiations on deep sea mining. And I don't drink coffee, but I love tea.
Okay, that's an interesting. Okay, yeah, we have some people who like tea. Okay. Sometimes I'm like, because I'm such a coffee addict, I'm like, okay, how do they function? How do they like get up in the morning? But yeah, you said it, you had the negotiations, and we'll dive into this in a second. But before, very briefly, we've touched based upon this in the intro, but how would you define deep sea mining if you had to explain it to an 11-year-old?
So basically, deep seabed mining is the next frontier of industrial mining companies that want to extract rare minerals like cobalt, nickel, manganese from the depth of the ocean. And it basically would have irreversible consequences for biodiversity, but also for our global climate, because the deep ocean is our biggest carbon sink. And the ocean as a whole is our climate stabilizer. So we all rely on the ocean, no matter where we live on Earth.
And you've mentioned these minerals. First of all, before we dive into the need, I mean, at least the argument for the need for deep sea mining, what exactly would these people hoping to find on the floor of the ocean, of the deep ocean?
So there are three different ecosystems from the abyss that are targeted for deep sea mining. But the first one to be able to start soon is mining what we call polymetallic nodules. You have to picture like small potato-sized rocks, black rocks that are filled with heavy, like with these metals. So cobalt, copper, manganese. And mining companies usually call these rocks a battery in a rock, because all the metals that you can find in here are useful to build batteries. Anything that has batteries, from our phones, our computers, to electric vehicles, etc.
And that's actually a great way to transition to my next question, which is, I've read it when preparing for this episode and in campaigning with Lookdown, is that one of the arguments from the industry, right, from a lot of companies, is that we need these minerals in order to power the energy transition. You've mentioned that these minerals are then used notably in batteries, so for electric vehicles and other stuff. Is that true? Do we need the minerals that we would find in deep sea mining for the energy transition? Can it be found in a different way? Is that a necessary step to fuel the energy transition?
Mm-hmm. So this is basically the biggest and I would say only argument that deep sea mining companies usually put forward, is the fact that we don't have a choice. The demand is so big that we have to mine in the deep sea. And actually, independent scientific reports show the contrary, that we don't even need to mine the deep sea bed to get to our energy transitions. And also they show that deep sea mining would never replace terrestrial mining. So also the argument of saying that deep sea mining would have less impacts than terrestrial or land-based mining is also not true, because you will just end up having two different very disasters on land and underwater. And so basically what these reports show is that we can meet the demand if we firstly invest in a circular economy, in recycling facilities for this kind of e-waste, so all the metals that have already been extracted, and today we don't know how to recycle them, and also through battery innovations. For instance, Tesla is now commercializing a new line of product that don't use any cobalt or nickel, and these two are the most are the two metals that mining companies want to look forward to having in the deep sea. And also the sobriety of using is also obviously a big topic and a big thing to move forward. So there are many reasons why, but there are also another more technical or related to feasibility reason, that is we don't even know yet how to process the metals that deep sea mining companies want to extract. So they want to start mining in the coming month, but we don't have the technology to be able to extract the metals that they need from these potato-sized rocks, so polymetallic nodules. So it might take like a decade before the technology is here.
Exactly. And this actually reminds me of the conversation around, you know, just renewables in general, is that we can't just, you know, keep pushing for renewables if it doesn't come without sobriety, because we're never going to be able to catch up to demand. And this feels like the exact same debate, really. It's about exploring and extracting more in order to make more money and increase profits for an industry that isn't even necessary in the first place. But you mentioned some of the impacts, right? So can you dive in a little bit about the impacts? Because this is an ecosystem that we know very little about. So what are the scientists saying in terms of possible impacts of deep sea mining on the deep ocean floor?
So yeah, firstly, we know better the surface of the moon, that we know the depth of our ocean. less than 20% of the deep ocean has been mapped. So there is a lot of scientific uncertainties about what lives there. So each new scientific expedition into the abyss brings a lot of new discoveries, a lot of new species, a lot of new interactions between species that have never been found with living species yet, etc., etc. And so there are basically two types of impacts, so direct impacts and indirect impacts. So the first direct impacts would be firstly the destruction of ecosystems and the loss of species, and especially the loss of species that we maybe don't even know yet. So it would just like erase entire ecosystems, entire ecosystem functions as well, and species. So these are the most direct impacts. And then you have the sediment plumes that would be like you have to imagine like a big cloud of this silt that is deposed at the bottom of the ocean. And this would basically make like impact all the fish, all the species that live there. And these heavy metals would be also released into the water column. So these sediments and polluted with heavy metals would be impacted all the water columns, so from the bottom of the ocean up to the surface. So it would have dramatic consequences on all biodiversity. And the indirect impacts are all the sources of pollution, like light pollution, sound pollution, toxic pollution, like metallic pollution. And these would be able to travel with the currents up to several hundred kilometers wide around the mine site. So the impacts would be basically going in every direction, like a bit of a 3D, like from the bottom to the surface and on the sides as well. And the other and last indirect impact, and that's one of the scientists don't have any enough data, it's the climate impacts. So because as the deep ocean is storing a vast quantity of carbon that we emit in the atmosphere every year, all this carbon is like trapped in the sediments in the bottom of the ocean. And with the action of the machinery of deep sea mining companies, it would risk disturbing the key climate functions of the ocean, like the fact that it's our biggest carbon sink. But it will also risk liberating the carbon that has been sequestered into oceanic soils for like millions of years.
You mentioned this is what sort of what we know, right, in terms of impacts that deep sea mining would have. But there's also a lot of uncertainty. And this uncertainty is what sort of justifies a lot of the scientists saying now that we shouldn't go forward with deep sea mining because of that principle of precaution, which essentially means that when we don't have enough data about something, we shouldn't engage in it until we have more data. Is that what the scientists are saying? And is there a deadline that they're sort of giving to get more information about the impacts that deep sea mining would have?
So yeah, all the scientific community is really calling for what we call a moratorium, so a pause, basically, on deep sea bed mining until we have sufficient knowledge to be able to build a baseline. Because today we don't have, like, scientists know what the impacts will be. These are very well documented, especially on the biodiversity loss and the loss of ecosystems, etc. But what scientists don't have is enough data to be able to build a baseline. That means a point, like a reference point, from where we could evaluate the impacts, because we don't know now what is the what lives in the deep sea. So how can we be sure that these won't have dramatic consequences if we don't know what's already there, right? And the most recent scientific reports say that we would need at least a decade of research to be able to have enough environmental baseline, but it's basically between 10 to 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And now I want to ask you a question about probably an initiative, I'm going to call it that way, an organism that very few people know about, like it's often the case with these international institutions that is very much not in the public eye. It's the International Seabed Authority, aka ISA. Can you tell me a little bit about what it does, what its purpose is? And then we'll dive into the recent negotiations that just happened.
So the ISA, or the International Seabed Authority, is a UN agency that is based in Kingston in Jamaica, and it's basically charged with regulating deep sea bed mining. It was created in 1994, so almost 30 years ago. And so it's really funny because 30 years ago we didn't have the same context that we have, especially in terms of climate context. So it was created at a time where climate impacts were definitely not as present as today. And so it's also a question of is this authority still needed, you know, like in the time of climate urgency that we are now. And what is interesting with that institution is that it has a double mandate that is a big conflictual. Like on one hand, we ask the International Seabed Authority to open the door to deep seabed mining and to regulate deep sea mining companies. And then on the other hand, we also ask the same entity, the same institution, to protect the deep ocean for the benefit of humankind. And so these are two opposite kind of goals that can't be done by the same entity. So that's the big problem of how this organization works. We are basically asking the fox to guard the hen house. And these are the words from a scientist, a geologist named Sandor Muslow, and he was the chief scientist of the International Seabed Authority for 5 years before he quit in 2019. And these are his words, like from the inside of the ISA. So it's very problematic in a way, because the main problem is that we don't have an independent scientific body that can monitor what these guys are doing and also monitor deep sea mining companies. Because today we are basically asking them to regulate themselves. Problem of transparency, which is very big at the ISA as well. Because for 30 years, like these negotiators have been basically negotiating behind closed doors. Also, the system in itself is very opaque, but there is also a lack of representativity of the main stakeholders that will be impacted. I think of Pacific Island communities, but also the youth, you know, so it has lots of different issues that make scientists also ask for an institutional reform of the ISA, because today, as it is not fit for purpose.
The parallels with COPs are really striking to me when you say that. Like, just, you know, the lack of transparency, the mandate essentially given to, especially with COP28, given to the industry to regulate itself. It's really striking. Can you maybe touch base briefly on this whole sponsoring thing? Because for me, it's just insane how countries sponsor private companies. I mean, they sort of work like it's a partnership. And it's very striking, I think, when you first read it and you're like, ooh, wait, countries sponsor private companies that are supposed to do deep sea mining, but then countries also have their own positions. Yeah, it sounds like a glaring conflict of interest. So can you maybe explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, so today, maybe to clarify, there is no deep sea mining contracts that has been allowed. So what we have today is only exploration. Mining exploration contracts. So we have 30 different contracts that have been issued by the International Seabed Authority to countries that have to sponsor these companies. So it's like kind of a couple that has these the same contract for the two entities. And it can be a company, but it can also be a public research institution. For instance, in France, we had our contracts with IFREMER, which is a public institution on oceanographic research, basically. And so these kind of couples, so the scientific or company and the states, have these contracts at the ISA, which is today an exploration contract. So they can only send boats out in the ocean and verify what metals lay there and how they'll be able to collect and to extract them, maximizing basically the profit by doing so. On the 30 contracts that has been issued, 19 are in the same area, which is called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone. And it's basically in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, because all contracts that have been approved under the ISA are in the high seas. So it's outside of the jurisdiction of each state. And so today is basically the far west. Like, there is no rule, no legislation that can apply. And so everything would be basically happening in the Pisces and specifically in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, and of course, if you have a boat which is literally in the middle of nowhere, there's very little chance that it's going to be able to be watched, and what it's doing is going to be able to be watched. So in 2021, the Pacific nation of Nauru in Micronesia took one big step closer to deep sea mining, announcing its intention to begin commercial exploitation of the seabed. That triggered something that maybe you'll be able to explain, an obscure two-year rule that gave the International Seabed Authority a deadline to finalize its rule book for environmental regulation. And the deadline is now very close because it's July 2023. And after this point, theoretically, the deep sea could be mined without environmental regulation in place. Can you maybe explain a bit more that two-year rule and what's happening right now? What's at stake today?
So this Pacific island state called Nauru is a very small republic. It has like 10,000 inhabitants. So it's a very small state of the South Pacific Ocean. And it's basically sponsoring a company that is based in Canada, which is called the Metals Company, which is basically known as being like the biggest deep sea mining company. And so Nauru, under the influence of TMC, as we call them, or the Metals Company, has been triggering this rule. So the 2 years trigger rule, basically from the moment when it's triggered by a state and a company, it gives this countdown of 2 years to all member states at the ISA to agree on a mining code, so a legislative framework that will be able to be a guideline for mining companies before opening the doors to the industrial deep sea mining, so really at the global scale. And this deadline, in a way, is the 9th of July, 2023. So it's very, very soon. And starting from July 2023, all mining companies that want to mine the deep sea will be able to submit what we call a plan of work. And this plan of work, or this contract for exploitation, would be able to be approved even in the absence of a mining code, because 2 years is definitely not enough to draft a strong and robust mining code, especially because we lack the basic scientific data and we lack this environmental baseline. So we are absolutely not able to explain the scale of the impact because we don't have this point of reference at the very basis. So that's why all scientists has been really raising the alarm for the past few years, but also especially more vividly since like the past since July 2020. And all the this basically activation of the rule has accelerated all the negotiation processes. Usually the ISA meets to define the mining code once a year, and now since the activation of this deadline, we everyone meets so 3 times a year. Basically it's the idea of TMC, so the Metals Company, that wanted to mine the deep sea as quickly as possible for their own profits and pushing everyone else to agree on a framework, even though we don't have the data to be able to have a robust framework.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you've been campaigning for with the Lockdown movement, which is a grassroots activist movement in several countries, is a moratorium. So maybe can you define what is a moratorium and maybe give an overview of what's been happening in the next few months, because it's been extremely intense. Several countries have positioned themselves in favor of a moratorium or a pause, in the process. Yet the negotiations happened. And maybe can you, first of all, what is a moratorium, I guess, and then we'll dive into what were the outcomes of the negotiations that you just attended in Jamaica.
Yeah, so the moratorium is basically just a pause by definition. It's the idea of pressing the pause button, not opening the doors to deep sea mining in the absence of scientific data that will be able to prove that no harm will be made to the environment and also to our global climate. And so scientists are basically calling for this moratorium for at least a decade, because that's the kind of point of reference that scientists have to be able to have enough scientific data and to do more research. So the minimum of temporality of this moratorium or pause is 10 years, but some countries have basically been taking some different position. So we have kind of a big spectrum that goes from the pause of precaution and moratorium up to the ban, which is a total and indefinite ban on deep seabed mining. And
which so country was that? Was it France?
Yes, exactly. So France is at the other side of the spectrum, asking for a ban, and also having banned deep sea mining in its own waters as well. But between the pause and the ban, we have a wide array of positions of different countries, which are 14 today, 14 countries. And these movements of states was basically made by Pacific Island states that would be the first ones to be directly impacted by deep sea mining. So these states were Palau, Samoa, Fiji, and the Federated States of Micronesia. And thanks to these four Pacific Island states, they have been really triggering a big movement of opposition to deep sea mining. So the other countries we have is Chile, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Spain, New Zealand, France, Germany, Panama, and the two that joined the moratorium or the precautionary pause in March at the last negotiation were Vanuatu and the Dominican Republic. And so all the states agree on one thing, is that July 2023 is way too early. Like, we have to do something to prevent deep seabed mining from starting, because starting from July, there will be no walking back. Like, it would be irreversible.
And what were the outcomes of the negotiations? Was it enough to have these several countries position themselves in favor of a moratorium? Or are we still on the track for the boats to leave in July 2023?
So the meetings that we had in Kingston in March were the council negotiations. So the council is basically the executive organ of the International Seabed Authority. It's a very small handful of states. It's only 36 states that are basically usually negotiating the terms of the mining code. So it's very technical kind of discussions. But what's really interesting is that at these negotiations, because we have this urgency triggered by the 2 years trigger rule, the discussions were way more political than technical, which is really good. Because usually these discussions are basically like comma after comma and world after world, really very diving deep into the regulations that would be the framework for deep sea mining. But in March, we had many, many countries, even those that are not part of this group that I mentioned just before, saying that we need to take a step back and to say, okay, just wait a minute. Are we really going to let deep seabed mining start in July, knowing that we won't have enough strong environmental regulations, and we don't have enough scientific data, and we don't have enough transparency as well? So it was really encouraging to see a lot of states taking the matter into their hands. We had, for instance, Belgium has a really great position. Switzerland, Portugal, the Netherlands, Brazil as well, even Jamaica, which is the host country of the International Seabed Authority, and it's the first time that Jamaica has been having this kind of position. So we basically have a very big movement of states just agreeing on the fact that July is too early, but we didn't have any agreement reached in March. So we still need to push a lot of countries to join this group of countries calling for a moratorium, a pause or a ban before July this year.
Yeah. Okay, so this is actually my last question, is what needs to happen between now and July, and what can people do? What can some people who are maybe listening to this episode or read an outrageous article about deep sea mining and like, this cannot happen, we cannot let the ships leave in July. How can they get involved and what can they do?
Mm-hmm. So basically, the only people that has the power to stop deep sea mining or to prevent deep sea mining from starting are states. So the biggest thing that we can do is push all remaining states to take a stance. So that's what we've done with the lockdown in France last year in 2022, for instance. So what people can do is firstly join all lockdown actions that we have, especially in the key remaining states. We have Belgium, Italy, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Monaco as well. And even if you don't live in those countries, reaching out to your parliamentarians, talking about deep sea mining to the press is a very, very crucial step, because this topic is very, very a little unknown from the greater public. The ocean is already very far from our everyday lives, but the deep ocean, wow, it seems like, yeah, so far away from all of us. And we actually rely, all of us, on the deep ocean for our conditions of living. So I think what's really interesting with deep sea mining, I think, is that we really have a unique opportunity that we usually don't have. We are never able to prevent a destructive industry from starting. Here we have this chance. Like, if we could have like stopped, I don't know, oil and gas, or in the 70s or the 80s, like it would definitely be another world we'd be living in. So it's really a huge opportunity, and it's also, I think, I'm very optimistic, and I really think that activism works, and that we can actually prevent deep sea mining from starting. And so we have these political actions that we have to take. And if you go on the Lockdown Action page on Instagram, you'll find many different actions to take very easily from wherever you are in the world. For instance, sending like pre-written emails to the Belgian government, to the investors of TMC, because we have this kind of political front, but we also have this financial front, which is very important, because money rules everything, as we all know. And at each time we have an action, and each time we bring a new country to oppose deep sea mining, we see the stocks of TMC like just falling down, and all their investors exiting the industry, which is huge. So we really see that our action have a big impact. And also, like, we just had the COP15 agreement in December. We just had the BBNJ agreement a few weeks ago, which is the High Seas Treaty, which is basically a landmark historical treaty to protect the high seas. So we have also this kind of big wave of attention towards the ocean. So it's also a very key momentum in which we simply can't allow the destruction of the deep ocean, and at the same time like want to build marine protected areas in the high seas. Like, it makes no sense. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a really great way to give closure to this episode. It's the optimism and the fact that we have a real shot, as you said, at stopping this, and it's not something mm-hmm. that comes every day. Two more things. I've been involved in several lockdown actions, and I can confirm that it's super easy and it's super accessible, and it's probably one of the most important campaigns happening right now. So we'll definitely link in the description of the episode what you can do and which actions you can take. And just sort of concluding this episode with this quote from Paul Watson, which I really love, which is, "If the ocean die, we die," right? Mm-hmm. And not a lot of people realize that, because as you said, it's so far from us and it's very difficult to encompass everything that's in the ocean, yet it's absolutely crucial to our survival. So I wanted to thank you, first of all, for joining the episode today and for everything you've been doing for the past month and years on this issue. You are truly a force of nature, and we should all be very grateful for the work you are doing with lockdown.
Thank you so much, Chloe. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Burning Case. We hope you liked it. If you want to support the podcast, click follow on Spotify or Apple Music or wherever you listen to your podcasts. It will help others find us. Also, if you think other people might find our content interesting, don't hesitate to share on your social media or in the old-fashioned way by talking about us to your friends and community. We hope you'll be back for the next episode. Have a great day!